The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Marxist theory, whose fundamental object of analysis has always been a world composed by capital, has nevertheless often remained cloistered within the national linguistic landscape and local canonical boundaries. The Marxist theoretical tradition in Asia, Africa, and Latin America has often been excessively localized as data rather than conceptualized as theory, treated as a horizon solely for the local political resolution of the national question. Yet for Marx, the national question itself was always already global in character, insofar as he noted that the sole precondition for world history was the moment when, quote, the owner of the means of production and subsistence finds the free worker selling his own labor power on the market. A meeting that nevertheless must be historically mediated within a local conjuncture. This conundrum then linked from the outset the clarification of capital's formal emergence locally to the emergence of the world as such as an object of analysis. This tension of the national capital and the quote world of capital constituted the central problematic for the late developing capitalist nations, particularly Japan in the 1920s, 30s. The theoretical innovations that were required in the conjuncture not only had to contend with their direct political application, but also formed a space in which theories served to allegorically deal with problems of history, from the unstable historicity of the capital relation, itself torn between its local and general aspects, to the, my computer did something very strange, to the conjunctural pressures of a rapid insertion into the category of world history. It is this tense globality of theory that ought to be recovered today so as to both productively incomplete our existing imaginary of the universal and generate, in theory, new universalities in Marxist thought. In the autumn of 1904, the 6th General Congress of the Second International was held in Amsterdam. The world situation preceding the abortive 1905 Petrograd Revolution was poised on a knife edge, nowhere more than Northeast Asia, where the region was engulfed in the Russo-Japanese War. Since the mid-Meiji period, and particularly by the 1890s, the Japanese Empire had expanded in an ever-increasing circular movement out from its central islands, with troops extensively stationed in the Korean Peninsula in the aftermath of its historic defeat of the Qing in the Sino-Japanese War of 1894-95, which saw the Japanese come to dominance in Taiwan and the beginnings of colonial presence in Korea, coming gradually into conflict with the Russian Empire's far eastern edges, setting up a confrontation of two, quote, late-coming imperial powers. At the 6th Congress, the most memorable and powerful address in the minds of the delegates of world revolutionary politics was that of the Japanese socialist theoretician and social revolutionary Katayama Sen, member of the first body of the Comintern. Katayama's remarks were transcribed by another active transnational militant from the Polish section of the Russian Social Democrats named Rosa Luxemburg, whose own writings on the national question would become central documents of 20th century Marxism. Katayama did something quite unprecedented in the midst of war. He declared openly that the interests of the Japanese working and popular classes and all nationally oppressed peoples in the Japanese early empire, not formal empire at this stage, lay not with their nation, but against it. Plekhanov, from the other side, gave a similar speech from the Russian group. In essence, this episode can be seen as one of the first historical moments that 20 years later, in the mid-1920s, would lead to the so-called debate on Japanese capitalism. And interestingly enough, there's a really fantastic archival document for this 6th Congress of the Second International, which is Daniel de Leon's remarks about the Congress, which are really amazing. They're like incredibly catty. He sort of talks about, you know, who's well-dressed and who's badly dressed, and, you know, makes sort of really snide remarks about different sections. That's very interesting. Although it's a little known fact outside of research on the history of Japanese philosophy and social thought, Marxism was perhaps the most dominant strand of theoretical inquiry in Japanese intellectual life throughout the bulk of the 20th century. From its initial entry into the Japanese intellectual world in the late 1800s, Marxist analysis came to constitute a vast and osmotic field that permeated all aspects of academic life, artistic practices, forms of political organization, and means of analyzing the social situation. Numerous episodes testify to this. For example, the dominant one, little known but true, the first language in which a collected works of Marx and Engels was published was not German, Russian, English, nor any other European language, but in fact, Japanese in 1931-32. As the major developed country relative to its neighboring states and primary imperialist power in East Asia, the Comintern considered Japan the most important and pivotal target for the revolutionary project. But in the wake of the 1927 Comintern thesis on Japan, which emphasized that the 1868 Meiji Restoration had not yet been fully accomplished as the, quote, necessary bourgeois democratic revolution and transition to modern world capitalism, the question thus emerged, was Japanese capitalism in the 1930s ready for socialist revolution? In its conditions on the ground, was it possible to discover the revolutionary subject of this process? In the clarification of this question emerged the famous and influential, quote, debate on Japanese capitalism, Nihon Shonji Gironzo, a debate whose centerpiece was the clarification of the essential questions of mode of production and the historical process of articulation of the social formation. What stage of development was Japan actually in? How and by what means had Japanese capitalist development proceeded? And did there exist a concomitant total development of the social formation as a whole, thus producing the, quote, political consciousness necessary for the revolutionary transition? Was the basic economic category of social life in the villages, the form of land tenancy rent, or hosakuryo, and the fight over this term, hosakuryo, is sort of the essence of the whole debate, was this a holdover or a remnant of feudalism, something partially feudal or a product of the development of modern world capitalism? The debate on Japanese capitalism in its encyclopedic sense took place roughly between the mid-1920s and the mid to late 1930s, a concentrated period of approximately 12 to 15 years. This debate, while unquestionably central to Marxist theory in the Japanese context and in fact to Marxist theoretical analysis in the Korean Peninsula and elsewhere in Northeast China and so forth, had an exceptionally broad influence on the formation of Japanese social thought as a whole and particularly on the formation of modern Japanese social sciences. In the debate on these questions, there emerged roughly two positions. One, which became that of the so-called dono, or labor farmer, labor peasant faction, who argued that the land reforms instituted in the 1868 Meiji Restoration, which they considered a properly bourgeois democratic revolution, had begun the solution to the, quote, backwardness of the countryside, planting the initial seeds that would lead to full capitalist development. On the other hand, another perspective, which became that of the koza, or lectures faction, representing the mainstream line of the JCP and the Comintern, argued that the restoration had not been a full bourgeois democratic revolution, but rather an incomplete transition to modernity, and that Japanese capitalism was therefore only partially developed on a primarily feudal basis. The 1927 Comintern thesis, in splitting from earlier emphases on the immediate socialist revolutionary process, installed the conditions for the split between the Japan Communist Party and the Dono faction. Subsequently, in the 1932 Comintern thesis, they reinforced this position further in parallel to the world situation, calling for mass-based bourgeois democratic revolution against absolutism and feudalism concentrated in the form of the emperor's system, Tennōsei. The primary authorial and conceptual influence on this period of Comintern policy on the national question was Ato Kushinen, the Finnish, very famous Finnish communist of 1920s, 30s, who in the 12th plenum of the Comintern in this same year called in general for mass-based actions which subordinated communist demands to the immediate needs of the broad mass front against fascism. By arguing that a directly communist political platform would alienate and keep the party separate from the rural poor and the so-called non-advanced strata of the working class, this call, issued in 1932 around the Japanese national question, essentially began the transition in the Comintern to the line of the Popular Front, which would be developed a few years later in 1935. In Japan, the Koza faction's position and dominance of this debate was comprehensively established with the publication of their 8-volume Lectures on the History of the Development of Japanese Capitalism in 1932. The works in this volume were in preparation well before the publication of the 1932 thesis, and therefore should not be seen as an expansion of the position of the Comintern, but rather as preparing the ground for the hegemony of its position. Noroue Taro, the leader of the JCP, very famous early figure of Japanese communist movement in the 20s and 30s, who was arrested and died in prison 2 years later in 1934, oversaw the compilation of lectures. Noro could be seen as the one who most concretely laid the groundwork for the overall conceptions of the JCP. For him, the only true and effective way to articulate the political consequences of theory, of proletarian strategy, was to focus on what he called the particularity, tokushusei, of Japanese capitalist development. The reason for this, Nodal claimed, was that without understanding not the dominant mode of production, but what he called the dominated mode of production, i.e. the agrarian semi-feudal structure of the countryside, one could not understand the particular way in which the development of the productive forces in the Japanese context necessitated a turn to imperialism. This basic logic could be understood as the position staked out throughout the volumes of the lectures and was the sort of mainstream position of the JCP. Outside Japan, on March 2, 1932, at a meeting of the Executive Committee of the Comintern, Otto Kushinen, then leader of its Eastern Bureau and charged with preparing analyses of revolutionary conditions in East Asia, made a presentation on Japanese imperialism and the nature of the Japanese Revolution, in which he argued that the Communist Party of Japan had made errors in its underestimation of the imperial system and the struggle against feudalism. In this text, Kushinen makes a number of decisive points highly influential on the Japanese situation on Marxist theory in Japan. Perhaps the most important formulation is as follows, quote, "We observe the uninterrupted and limitless oppression of the peasantry conditioned by the exceptionally powerful remnants of feudalism. The Japanese village is for Japanese capitalism a colony contained within its own domestic limits." He continues, quote, "Japan's bourgeois transformation remains remarkably incomplete, remarkably inconclusive or non-determinate, and is in essence partial and unfinished," end quote. Precisely because of these features, he argued, Japanese capitalism is permanently crippled or deformed. In May of the same year, 1932, the Western European Bureau of the Comintern released their decisive statement, Theses on the Situation in Japan and the Tasks of the Japanese Communist Party, the so-called famous 1932 thesis, based in large part on the analysis undertaken by Kushinen in the previous March documents. The 32 thesis is not a purely historical document, quite to the contrary, it's a document of revolutionary strategy and tactical considerations in the immediate situation. By focusing on the nature of Japanese capitalism, the Comintern highlighted precisely Kushinen's argument about the sort of nature of the feudal remnant as the living and institutional concretization of Japanese imperialism. The emperor system was this thing that linked together both external plunder and internal oppression. As a digression from this sort of debate, I want to talk slightly about how this debate was received. When I wrote my recent book, which sort of deals with this or takes off from this basic point, my main sense was that previously existing studies of the debate on Japanese capitalism in all languages, particularly English, Japanese, French, and German, but also Russian, where it was extensively analyzed, had emphasized excessively a sort of delimited and nationally or civilizationally bounded documentary history of this debate, at the expense of understanding, first and foremost, its globality and its theoretical core. And this fact has implications for what the tasks in Marxist historiography on such questions are at all. In that sense, what interested me then, and when I began the project, and what continues to interest me, is the question of what was really at stake in this debate after all. In a certain sense, in the end, I think the nature of the debate on Japanese capitalism and the terms in which it took place served to occasionally obscure the genuine struggles at issue in its essence. To cut a long story short, the specific nature of the so-called transition debate, and this is a transition debate in the same style as the debate of Dobbs-Sweezy in the 1950s, there's in fact a direct link between this debate and the Dobbs-Sweezy debate. Takahashi Kohatsu, who is a very famous historian of French feudalism and more or less weighed in on the side of Dobbs, was in fact a direct student of Yamada Moritaro, the main theoretician of the JCP of the 1920s and 30s. So there's a sort of immediate linkage. But to cut a long story short, the specific nature of this transition debate as it took place in Japan, in my view, was not so much a social historical reckoning with the origins of something called Japanese capitalism, so much as it was an indirect debate on the global status of the subject in history and the relationship between the theoretical content of Marx's capital and the immediate social, political, or political historical scenario in which knowledge of the direct conjuncture always furnishes the necessary background to political action. The trends of historiographical analysis, largely associated with the JCP historians, always emphasized a sort of sublime and deterministic concept of feudalism. Feudalism became, in this optic, a sort of stand-in or container of significations for all that was treated as, quote, pre-modern, backwards, inadequately social or civic in the modern sense. In turn, this entire field of understanding tended to position a clear and orthodox continuum from primitive society to its capitalist present, relegating the feudal to an index of failure, a failed leap or incomplete transition to the modern and immediate now. Thus, feudalism was generally understood in two ways, either as the remote and overcome past, which was now falling into a sort of infinite regress of meaninglessness, or it was understood paradoxically as the present, as a discursive marker for Japan's supposed inadequacy on the scale of modern life. In this latter sense, feudalism came to be a marker for an entire series of supposedly, quote, cultural features, tendency towards bureaucratization, stagnation in the labor market, hyper-exploitation in the countryside occasioned by the supposed ideological backwardness of the peasantry, tendencies towards militarism, secrecy, and mystification at the political level, and inability to overcome the features of a putatively closed and coercive social order. The main tendency in theory installed by the JCP historians, therefore, was precisely to link up those features of nominal, quote, Japaneseness at the commonsensical level with a world historical program that would not only, quote, explain these features on a global scale, but that would also provide a sort of master narrative for the inability of politics to sufficiently respond to the immediate situation. Here, in a sense, politics proper was rendered impossible or structurally stillborn by means of the national formations incapacity to objectively leap to a new basis of accumulation, which would therefore produce, in the course of generating new social and political forms, a new political subject, this kind of very mechanistic relationship between the subjective capacity of politics and the objective social scenario was kind of hallmark of this debate. Let us recall the formulation of Kushinen and the Comintern's Eastern Bureau, practically shared by the majority of JCP's thinkers and their disciples throughout the discipline of history at this time. Japanese capitalism for them was characterized as, quote, incomplete, inconclusive, and partial or unfinished. That is, for the Comintern, Japanese capitalism as such does not yet exist at all. The total social system that an economic life founded on the category of free labor would produce has not yet for them emerged. And it's this that is treated as the sort of precursor, or in fact, what Marx called the preface, right? And he uses this word preface. Einleitung is the kind of this appearance of labor power in the market. It's this that's treated as the sort of precursor or preface to the possibilities not only of another social order, but another possibility of politics. And here I think it's extremely important to point out that within the JCP historians there was a kind of interesting and significant difference in terms of what they argued. A certain faction for the concept of feudal remnant, and then one particular figure, Yamada Moritaro, who made the argument on the basis of what he called semi or quasi-feudalism. And this is, I think, a very important distinction. That is, in other words, Yamada Moritaro argued not that capitalism in Japan did not exist, but rather that it did exist and that it was not disabled by putatively feudal features, but precisely enabled by them. By describing this kind of thought image of Japanese capitalism as semi-feudal, he made a kind of decisive wager by inserting this concept semi, or han in Japanese, like half, in other words, sort of half-feudal or semi-feudal, quasi-feudal, this weird element of undecidability that, in fact, refused the substantialist fantasy of the transition as a single and contentless leap from one mode of life to another, as if these were clearly bordered and bounded entities from which one was either inside or outside. But why this kind of incredibly sort of sublime vision of feudalism that they had? And why use this term sublime at all? I want to emphasize this point in two directions. In essence, the debate on Japanese capitalism was a debate on the nature of feudalism in Japan, the nature of tenant farm rent, or kosakuyo. But it was also a debate over the meaning of modes of production themselves. That is, it was a debate that considered the truly essential meaning of the analysis of modes of production, the relationship between structure and politics, between structure and subject, the possibility or closure of politics, of class struggle, within the analysis of the overall structural features of the economic and social scenario, one that was conditioned by forces outside the purely subjective and experiential. In this sense, the feudal as a concept was always extremely remote from this debate. It enabled simply a set of discursive operations that sort of made the feudal itself into a kind of metonymic device. It could stand in for backwardness, it could generate in one word a whole morphology of development, it could stand in for Japaneseness itself, an inadequately modernized concept of culture as a stable stratum of givenness, for instance. But But in sort of thinking about this, the peculiarity of this sublime concept of feudalism, it was located predominantly around two questions. One, the insistence that free labor, quote unquote, is the condition sine qua non for the establishment of modern capitalism, and therefore in turn for the emergence of the modern political subject of a stable and so-called normal national society. In essence, in contrast to the Weberian formulations, Yamada Moritaro, in fact, reminded us that this absolutely did not characterize the employment of labor at the outset of the Meiji period, when the legal character of state formation did not serve to free the Bakumatsu peasantry from its extensive oppression, but rather enforced the already existing oppressions by means of a new legal legitimacy. But does this mean that what emerged in Japan in the Meiji period was an incomplete or only partial capitalism? We have recourse here to Marx to clarify this point for us. If, as we recall in Marx's own terms, the quote, normal transition to capitalism in the English countryside is one fable or story among others, what sets it in motion? What is the prelude or quote, preface for the development of this normal narrative of capitalist development that was negatively imagined in the debate on Japanese capitalism? For Marx, there's a very specific answer from Capital Volume 1. The purchase, quote, the purchase of labor power for a fixed period is the prelude to the process of production. And this prelude is constantly repeated when the stipulated term comes to an end, when a definite period of production, such as a week or a month, has elapsed. This Einleitung, and we see here clearly the literary term, preface, introduction, preamble, prelude, etc., shows us that it is above all the purchase of the labor power commodity that's the necessary moment of commencement for capital, and the emergence of labor power, as we now know from texts like, for instance, I think here of Jean-Louis Bouton's work, De l'esclavage au salariat, which is really a kind of extraordinary book. We know that, in fact, the purchase, the emergence of the labor power commodity is in no way dependent on the specifically European presupposition of free labor as conditioned by juridical or de facto freedoms. In that sense, to return to the conclusion, to the sort of prelude of this talk, the transition debates on the origins of capitalism have tended all over the world to mirror exactly the vision of competing narratives staked out in the first major theoretical debate on the transition worldwide, the Japanese one. If anything is sort of sorted out or concluded from this earlier debate, or indeed from the debates of the 1950s, 60s, 70s, it is precisely that the transition, understood as a unitary and single moment of the spark of modern social and economic systems, has always been absent, and no amount of documentary evidence has ever changed this. But that its meaning and the struggle over its allegorical content has never ceased to function. In thinking the nature of this debate, so formative for the humanities in the Japanese case that we can scarcely find a field it did not impact, historical analysis runs up against the limits of its ceaseless drive or compulsion for data, because nothing in the debate could be settled by that older mode of historical analysis, except by that older mode of historical analysis, a form suspended between philology and philosophy, in Croce's terms. Anyone who's an actually working historian in a history department would probably shock their colleagues if they said, you know, what is history, but it's a form suspended between philology and philosophy. I would like to make this argument as a, you know, person working in the history department, but not many people do. Anyway, we have recourse to Benedetto Croce for this. It's this sense that a thinking of the sort of contemporaneity and direct globality of the formative moments of the Marxist tradition in Japan remind us. Its point of departure was not, quote, Japan, as some sort of alien, remote situation of excessive theoretical peculiarity. It was the nexus of social forms generated between global capital and the form of the nation state, which, let's be honest, is a nexus that continues to structure our own conjuncture in the present. Thank you.
Next, we have Harry Hartunian, if you are ready to roll.
Yeah, I'm going to probably have to cut a lot of this. I mean, it's a trouble with these damn things. Spend all the time putting something together, and then you have to cut it. The thematic thread that I want to follow, exemplified by Japan, is that the experience of uneven development is not limited to capitalist latecomers, but implicates all societies committed to its production agenda. For this reason, we are, I believe, obliged to respond to its demands of entertaining entertaining of a global perspective, because there is no pure development as supposed by earlier versions of Marxian discourse, or a modular form that prescribes for all unitary linear developmental trajectory divided into progressive stages. As the Japanese economist Uno Kozo observed in Japan's case, capital's development was marked principally by variations produced by combining received historical practices and capitalism's law of law of motion, suggesting from the beginning that the former making substantive appropriations and combinations accompanied capital's global origins. In other words, the origins of capitalism derived from the production of uneven development right from the very beginning, and the combining shaped by appropriating what is near on hand, as later elaborated by Trotsky into a larger conception of permanent revolution. Unevenness pointed to plural societies, relationality, and multiplicity of different pathways of the historical development of capitalism that made each manifestation intrinsically worldly. It also brought with, and I'm quoting obviously a familiar phrase, with their accompanying train manifest non-contemporaneous or non-synchronous temporalities that are contemporary with one another, indexing historically different formations such that each has utilized. Yet capital's aptitude for formal subsumption especially in high or hybrid forms supplied its new everyday with the capacity to expand its power of absorbing incommensurables into other domains of the social formation, beyond the economic and the contemporizing pasts. In addition, we must be attentive, I believe, to original context distinguished by no clear differentiation between spheres of economic practices and determinations like culture, ideology, politics, customary law, and religion, which certainly at the earlier periods of modern history were not sufficiently separated from each other and were often integral to the performance of work and production. It is also possible to acknowledge how practices from the non-economic domain have continued to be essential to the conduct of work and work and production, but also to the changing nature of politics, religion, and law. Finally, this observation brings us to the perception that the operation of the logic of subsumption implies a much broader discursive range, as Etienne Balibar has pointed out, than merely the unilateral act of seizing command and control or over conventions of work by retrofitting them with forms of the commodity serving capital's pursuit of value. Such a perspective requires recognizing a relationship of subsumption to labor, non-economic domains, to other non-economic domains, as I will try to briefly explain with reference to Japan's reconfiguration of an archaic imperial figure in the late 19th century. The point here is to broaden the logic of subsumption to account for it as an ongoing global process that must be seen to involve the incorporation of other dimensions like the cultural, political, religious, as necessary conditions for the reproduction of capitalist society, determinations actively involved in the continuing struggles over subsumption. Grasping the actualization of subsumption as a global process beyond the economic and its relationship to plural determinations opens the pathway to seeing the production of history as always uneven development. It is precisely this dialectical interaction between history and capital logic, the capacity of producing combinatories out of incommensurables in different moments and places, that brings us back to the Japanese experience. I'm going to really talk back and forth between a little bit of earlier history, pre-war Japanese history, and then move into the post-war, but I'm not observing any real chronological conventions here. In the post-war Japan of the current Prime Minister Abe Shinzo, we can detect the rumor of revival in which the archaic and contemporary capital are actively being pursued to constitute the sign of a repetition. A repetition Svetlana Alexeyevich has named Secondhand Time, and whose excessive nostalgia for the recovery of a specific past must be seen as a return of fascism in a new historical register. On the face of it, this revival appears to be bringing together the past with the capitalist present, as Marx recommended earlier in his letters to Vera Zasulich. But this past that is being redeemed is the experience of Japan's fascist experience in a repetitive fusion of the archaic and capital, in which the former lacks the contemporaneity Marx recognized in the existence of the Russian Commune and an eventual Russian Revolution. And Marx is very clear about that, even though he kind of elaborates, you know, in those letters about the importance of the Commune and using the Commune. He also said that Russia has to have a revolution along the way. The difference between what Marx had proposed and its later fascist deformation was an archaism under the sign of a restoration that coexisted with contemporary capital and was fixed in the present, that proved to be driven by fictive conjuration seeking to transmute a present into a recovered past. Under Abe's second prime ministry, there has been a discernible resurgence of radical conservatism bordering on recalling the forms of Japan's pre-war fascist interlude, fueled by the state's efforts to eliminate difference with breathtaking speed, often backed by threats of violence and coercion. It is demanding from the population sacrifice and acquiescence. All of this has been occurring behind the screen provided by the image of Japan as the democracy, bolstered by the country's client status in the American imperium. With the Abe regime, there has been a steady attempt to replace the post-war political imaginary through what is called, I'm quoting now, a regime change that seeks to rescue the pre-war in the modality of this secondhand time, propelled by the persistent drumbeat sounding out the necessity of Japan's return to another, more authentic time, to live in a different now time. The stated purpose of Abe's regime change is, I'm quoting again from one of the party documents, to recover the living principles of the time of the imperial state, which principally refers to the discredited fascist and imperialist past of the pre-war era. At the heart of the contemporary move to recover a prior temporal moments and its enabling principle is the recurring figure of restoration and its indelible relationship to the emperor. What this figure immediately evokes is Japan's modern transformation that signaled a return to the world and the stain of unevenness that necessitated the imperatives of overcoming it. The anxiety prompting this desire to overcome unevenness derived from the mistaken belief that late economic development had committed a society to a permanent delay and even deferral of achieving catch-up. The fear of delay was further reinforced by the circulation of world Darwinian interpretive trajectories like Herbert Spencer and others that equated late development with stages of backwardness, always in comparison to the advanced modularity claimed by Euro-America's early development. Hence, the Meiji Restoration itself of the Emperor in 1867 or 68, depending on how you want to count those years, to putatively direct rule, satisfied two demands. One, according to a number of historians, returning the Emperor entailed resolving the historical crisis of the structure of the pre-modern communal system, the Kyoto-tai, resulting from the penetration of capital in the countryside in the late Tokugawa period. The subsequent formation of a modern imperial ideology incorporated, quote, the living consciousness of this seismic pre-modern communal crisis. The restored emperor would embody the contradiction of the archaic and capitalist present through the act of repeating a moment out of time that prompted resolution by reinstalling the imaginary of the ancestral land, Sokoku, and its divinely appointed deputy, the emperor. Two, the Meiji Emperor, along with newly established shrines, national shrines like Yasukuni, was reconfigured to serve as a principal support of the state's decision to embark upon a massive capitalist transformation of Japanese society by becoming the object of unquestioned loyalty and absolute obedience among the population, which translated into making them work and die for the emperor, fulfilling the twin requirements of the Meiji state's slogan of wealth and power, Fukoku Kyohei. It should be added that while the state saw in the figure of an archaic emperor the necessary support for capital's development, one of the major Marxian factions, as Gavin has already pointed out, the Kozaha especially, considered the imperial institution as a feudal remnant, stalling economic and political development into a permanent static state of semi-feudalism and political absolutism. War's end and American military occupation, occupation's intention to democratize Japan revealed the primary purpose of the reforms was actually to restore Japan's capitalist endowment and the political conditions that would facilitate its realization, which meant, of course, retaining the emperor and returning the discredited political classes back to power. For our purpose, the central consideration remains the constitutional reforms, which replaced the old Meiji Constitution of 1889. And now, on the face of it, the contrast between these two documents couldn't be greater or more dramatic. The new Constitution, drafted by foreigners, conferred rights on citizens rather than duties of subjects, and vested sovereignty in a popular will instead of a divine emperor. But rather than acting to rid society of the emperor, whose centrality had actually configured the hierarchic shape of social relationships, the new constitution recoded the emperor, quote, as the symbol of the state and the unity of the Japanese people, end of quote. Before the war, the emperor had been sole absolute authority of the state and society, sacred and inviolable. The reference to the unity of the Japanese people had no historical existence. It was a fiction. What appeared as a transfiguration of Japan's prior constitutional endowment ended by recuperating its core principle. The emperor was effectively retained to perform as he had since the Meiji era, to mediate and balance the contradictions of uneven development from spilling over into social conflict to interfere in the continuing operations of capital accumulation. An emperor who still embodied both an archaic, erratic presence and contemporaneity, bringing together the old and the new, was already positioned to keep in balance the antinomies and contradictions threatening to undermine social order. In this way, the American military operation simply took over an imperial institution resembling what we would call basically a ready-made or a found object. The ready-made, the earlier Meiji state, had actually recomposed to act as the absolute guarantor of capital accumulation. This process once again resumed the task of producing unevenness and the constant interplay between capital logic and a contingent history, a repetitive process demonstrating how its effect is capable of radiating from different regions and times throughout the world to constitute its global nature. The decision to spare Hirohito from the hangman's noose, on which both MacArthur, General MacArthur, and the leading Japanese bureaucrats agreed, meant installing him to a position he effectively occupied before the war as the principal custodian of all the rituals and ceremonies binding the monarch, the national deities, ancestors, and to the people, into a persisting socio-political solidarity that constantly called attention to the primacy of an invisible realm or empire. While the emperor was obliged to renounce his divinity, and if you just pause upon that, I mean, only a divine person can actually disavow that he or she is a divine divinity. The Japanese Tenno was still called emperor, even though his earthly empire had shrunk and his territory now extended only to this invisible spiritual realm. It's unseen. But the temporality of his reign was still considered the measure of imperial time, as it still is today. Different from socially normative time of business and everyday life, yet capable of intervening and essentially finessing it. He presided over an unseen realm of gods, his alleged relatives, with whom he regularly communicated through the exercise of a calendar of rituals capable of enlisting the people into a permanent solidarity group cemented by his own mediation. The figure of an emperor was further reinforced by the occupation's decision to put Hirohito on the road for the population to see him in his new humanity, but it really didn't work. I mean, they saw him as an emperor, the monarch, it's still a divine monarch. In revisiting the retention of the emperor in post-war Japan, we must remember that since the Meiji period, when the institution and figure were reconfigured anew, it was the combination of its temporal anachrony and contemporaneity in every present that constituted the structure that bound the population to work and die for the emperor. With the occupation's recalling of the emperor, we have in effect another restoration that would bring back an imperial figure with what appeared as considerably stripped powers. Yet, like previous restorations, this reduced state would lead to the necessity of completing the unfinished restoration of 1868, as was attempted in the 1930s by right-wing firebrands, whom Mishima Yukio called runaway horses or omba. In the present of Abe Shinzo's Japan, the effort would be to carry out the completion of the failed restoration of the 1930s, not by self-sacrificing fascists, but by hired Yakuza thugs and bureaucrats. And I would just point out to you, this forms another rather interesting combination, if you think about it, consisting of traditional forms of criminality on the one end, and of course, well-trained Tokyo, Kyoto University-trained bureaucrats, you see, on the other end. What appeared so extraordinary about this refiguration and reinstallation of the emperor in the Meiji period, earlier time, is that it represented a deliberate decision to resituate the non-contemporary or non-synchronous represented by the figure of a monarch, embodying a divine genealogy and erratic presence stretching down to the archaic depths of the country's mytho-history of origins. In the center of a society committed to capital accumulation and technological transformation. Even more startling is the decision of the United States military occupation later on to retain this archaic figure and the domination of his presence in the reconsecration and reconstruction of Japanese capitalism after 1945, which meant recuperating and maintaining the historic contradiction marking the foundation of Japan's modern order. This was not any contradiction, I should say, but an absolute one that dictated the aura of authority integral to both the development of capitalism and the formation of its corresponding social structure. A divinely derived emperor who was still, according to the philosopher Tanabe Hajime, actually writing in the early years of the post-war period, inside and outside of history. You know, I mean, he had it both ways. Despite Hirohito's strategic disavowal of divinity. Because of his divinity, he had possessed the capacity to hold the contradictions between archaic residues and capitalist demands in a more or less constant balance and relatively free from igniting the occurrence of convulsions capable of tearing Japanese or Japan's social fabric apart. Only the emperor, owing to his position as the occupant of the place of nothingness, this is the way Tanabe dealt with this, now substituting for divinity in a new political environment, only the emperor, occupying the place of nothingness was above the fray of the conflict because he was no thing and free from ownership and could transcend it. And at the same time, he was also actively part of the human order. In Tanabe's post-war reformulation, the emperor's disavowed divinity, therefore, was replaced by nothingness, which he supposedly symbolized but in reality embodied. In this way, the emperor was still positioned, especially after Hirohito's declaration of his humanity, to unify contradictions and oppositions, yet retain his distance from partisan entanglements. He could still intervene in history, yet remove himself from its judgment. When the Russian filmmaker Alexander Sokurov has Hirohito, and it's a really great film, I recommend this film for everybody. It's a film called The Sun, S-U-N. He has Hirohito meditating, in other words, upon, see, he's supposed to go talk to MacArthur, and this is right in the early occupation, as to, you know, what he's going to say and what they're going to talk about. He tells his court chamberlain immediately, he says, my body is no different from anybody else's. And the court chamberlain immediately says, you should never say that. Now I think about that now with the emperor wanting to have to get. In any case, it's really, what Sokurov was trying to make a point here. He was trying to say that this is the way, this would become the basis of Japan becoming a democratic order. But I think he really overlooked the kind of argument there was, that Tanabe had already formulated, and then on which others would elaborate. Absent in Tanabe's formulation of nothingness as the new source of imperial power was the effect elicited by the emperor's inherent capacity to continually summon the national deities and imperial ancestors through his enactment of rituals and ceremonies. In these moments, the emperor communicates with his relatives, as I said, in the imperial genealogy, beseeching them to confer good fortune on the country and protect it. I'll just finish up in a minute. I just want to say a couple more things here, and then I'll just cut this short. Here, I believe, in other words, the core of the modern industrial, here, I believe, is the core of an evenness constituted by situating the figure of the archaic at the core of a modern industrial society. It must be just juxtaposed, on the other hand, to the observation that when Japanese are asked by foreigners whether they believe in all this imperial mummery, the question is dismissed by responding that nobody takes it seriously. In this respect, the Japanese historian Kan Takayuki has proposed that even though Japanese live daily with the dominant thought that they have no relationship to the emperor, they encounter, and I'm quoting from him, the shadow of the emperor every day, everywhere. From being made aware of the reign name that bears his name and thus partially living in imperial time through family genealogies and remembering ancestors, shrines, religious holidays, the national anthem, flag, and the acceptance of the idea that the emperor system is embedded in the Hamlet communal order, that is, according to Takeuchi Yoshimi, another perceptive intellectual of the post-war period, he is in every blade of grass and every tree leaf, making him inseparable from the environment in such a way as to serve as the containing framework of the population. In other words, the reminder of the emperor's presence is suffused throughout the daily life of Japanese society in countless ways one need not be conscious of that can hardly be dismissed by a mere verbal gesture that he is not thought about. Yet this mere verbal gesture aims to displace a complex belief system, a virtual cultural unconscious so deeply embedded in Japanese society that acknowledges the emperor's unimportance, that his unimportance announces a disavowal that signifies submission to the institution. Finally, I'll just end it there.
Sure.
Thanks, Harry. That was terrific. I'm last if we have another question.
I'm sorry?
Oh, I said thank you. That was terrific. No. That was excellent.
Okay, thank you. My talk is, the title has changed somewhat. I wanted to talk about actually what I'm calling, for lack of a better term, the cyclicality of nationalism, racism, and crisis. And I'd like to begin actually with a quote from Gavin, actually. Homo nationalis remains not merely a corollary or peripheral question to the broad concerns of capitalist development, but rather a profoundly historical field of force located at the very core of the logic of capital, in which the abstract individual who is the presumed subject of exchange is always presumed not merely as a subject, but as a national subject, end of quote. Thus writes Gavin Walker. As he comments specifically on Balibar's inquiry into the nation form, a term which Balibar calls the aggregate of apparatuses and practices that institute the individual as homo nationalis. Gavin, as we know, also continues to talk about how this abstract individual is the result of a complex transition, transformation, and even a transmigration that pivots and leverages around the labor power commodity. Which is to say that the essence of the transition, quote unquote, lies not so much in simply a movement from one mode of production to the other, but rather perhaps its suspension, particularly in relation to the commodification of labor power, which means, on the one hand, not only the sale and purchase of labor power, but also a process of capturing for capital's exploitation, this thing, which is not really a thing, which capital cannot produce, but which it must consume. Therefore, labor power, along with land, represents this omnipresent potential to actually interrupt capitalist circuits of reproduction by the sheer fact of its exteriority to capital. Capital must be lucky to find it, and if it is unlucky to find it, as I will talk about later, we have various agents of the nation state creating a milieu for apparatuses of capture and confinement to compensate for capital's Achilles heel. And at this point, I wanted to emphasize really something I've learned mostly from Uno Kozo, which is about the labor power commodity, as it represents a kind of represents a fundamental discontinuity in capital's reproduction process, even if this discontinuity is originally and periodically repressed, which allows capital to continue its circuits and to imagine itself, as it were, as a perfect circle of eternal motion. Labor power thus represents the paradoxical dialectical union of discontinuity and continuity of the capitalist world, and perhaps it's because of this paradoxical continuity of discontinuity that Uno Kozo argued and said that the phrase, the commodification of labor power, or in Japanese, Rodo Yoku no Shohinka, was his professed mantra. This mantra, the commodification of labor power, is, for Uno, it's not just an anecdotal thing. I think it really represents the fundamental riddle or question for capital. It's the permanent unanswered question which drives and motivates capital's inhuman and inorganic existence. It is the actual and repeating historical restriction on the capitalist mode of production, which capital cannot avoid yet must overcome no matter what. How capital can possibly overcome this restriction can only be answered by understanding the commodification of labor power as a process that passes through a series of apparatuses which represent bearers of labor power as national subjects, but which also inextricably subject populations to the nation form, subjecting and forcing them into a national existence as a result of an institutionalized judgment that condemns, with the force of the law, populations and bodies to the center or margins of an imagined nation, national community. And what I'd like to do eventually is emphasize this idea of condemning a body to the nation form to the same degree that bearers of labor power are condemned to the industrial reserve army. Condemned to the law of populations peculiar to the capitalist mode of production, which amounts to a condemnation to forced idleness, unproductive labor, inactivity, etc., which paradoxically turns out to be the defining characteristic of what is called the so-called free worker. This idea of condemnation, of being condemned to the nation, cannot be thought apart from what we could call nationalism, of course, but as Balibar points out, nationalism can never be thought apart from racism. And more specifically, what Balibar calls the cycle of historical reciprocity of nationalism and racism, which is the temporal figure of a progressive domination of the system of nation states over other social formations. So for Balibar, this domination over other social formations initially makes its appearance by the force of the state, which utilizes official nationalisms to transform antagonisms and persecutions, quote, that have quite other origins into racism in the modern sense, and ascribes verbal markers of ethnicity to them. And this is something I'd like to return to at the end when I talk about situate the Korean experience in Japan. But what I want to emphasize here is that if nationalism and racism form a reciprocal union that has a cyclicality to it, it's because antagonisms and persecutions call them into being from quite different origins, namely their origins in this difficult transition into or commencement or recommencement of the capitalist mode of production. What I wanted to add to this was something that I learned from Uno Kozo's theory of crisis. I believe that we need to connect this argument of Balibar's of the historical reciprocity of nationalism and racism with this with another cycle, namely the capitalist cycle of crises. it's not simply that nationalism and racism mutually constitute each other, rather this mutual reciprocity is a cycle, implying perhaps that there are phases of this cycle when nationalism may be relatively uncoupled with racism, while in other phases they might be combined into a terrible fusion. One could easily argue, or too often argue, that the basis of this cycle of nationalism and racism rests upon cycles of the state and of governments and policies. However, even if the state cycles can be said to determine the cyclical nature of nationalism and racism into this or that particular concrete determination, especially from a legal point of view, in the capitalist epoch, as Marx calls it, the state cycles are inescapably reacting to capital cyclicality, which, as Marx reminds us over and over, abides by its own deranged repetition compulsion, independently of the state. Particularly alarming for the state are periodic outbreaks of financial crisis and the appearance of what Marx calls excess capital coexisting alongside surplus populations, which represents a kind of tension where there's a suspension of precisely this process of the commodification of labor power. It's precisely during this time that we see the extensions of the state and these apparatuses cycling around the riddle of the commodification of labor power, now as a national question or a national problem, which it polices, which the state polices coldly and cruelly, calling forth the state to act and decide on its manner, mode, and technique of intervention to mediate this uneasy alongsidedness between excess capital and surplus populations. What I wanted to then raise was basically, I have to put this down for a second because it's just too much. I've simply wanted to emphasize a couple things so far. One is that the problem of the national question is we're trying to force a reconsideration of how the national question appears within not only the transition, but the transition considered in relation to the commodification of labor power as the Achilles heel of the circular logic of capital. It represents a gap in this logical cycle. This gap represented by the commodification of labor power, a gap defined in terms of capital's drive to consume this thing which it cannot produce, this tension. And this gap is also then mimicked by this thing called excess capital coexisting alongside surplus populations. And it's in that gap that I think we need to question and bring in this question of the national question and with racism. But the second point that Uno makes is that we can't just rely on that kind of reading of Das Kapital to really get to these questions of nationalism and racism without considering the problem of capitalism in its imperialist stage. One, why? For many reasons, but the one point I want to emphasize, which is something Uno's theory of crisis really brings out, is that when we look at the pure cycle of capitalist motion, we can, on the abstract level of Das Kapital, we can break down accumulation into three phases: prosperity, crisis, and recession. And obviously, in the recession phase, that's where we see excess capital coexisting alongside surplus populations. The importance of considering capitalism now, not only in this pure theoretical space, but as a historical system that develops into imperialism, is that in the stage of imperialism, because of the dominance of finance capital and its investments in huge fixed capital, we see that in phases of recession especially, we see that tension of excess capital coexisting alongside surplus populations becomes extremely tense and extremely volatile. And that's exactly the background for which against which we can consider more concrete experiences, for example, of colonized Korean workers in Japan. We cannot understand their struggles unless we understand how workers, Korean workers, were recruited into Japan, specifically in a prolonged phase of industrial recession following World War I. And it's in that prolonged chronic recession after World War I, before World War II, that we see Korean populations coming into Japan, subjected to the national form, and we see in a brief, for example, before the recession, in a four-year period of industrial prosperity during World War I, we see Korean workers recruited by Japanese industry. Why? To break the backs of Japanese trade unionism, which is going on the offensive, demanding higher wages and so forth. Korean workers are brought in to break the backs of Japanese trade unionism. And yet we don't see like an outrageous racism towards Koreans at that time in this four-year period. We see a kind of, I would call it a kind of racialization, where they note the difference, but it's only in the recession period where we start to see the racialization becoming a racism. When Koreans, for example, are the first to be fired from the industrial system that they were brought into, break the trade unionism of the Japanese workers, and we start to see Koreans funneled systematically through various state apparatuses and their satellite agencies out of the industrial sector and into the day labor market, where they are systematically exploited not only for cheap labor and manual labor, but through a specific wage regime that harkens back to precisely these feudal eras, the feudal modes of organizing workers. It was called a system of organizing workers in large groups, where the wages would be paid in a manner that would basically take off percentages of the wages depending on who was recruiting the workers, so on and so forth. And we start to see the semi-feudal mode of exploitation, which the Koreans continually pointed out to the Japanese trade union workers, saying, look, we're not exploited in the same way. We are exploited in what we call an intermediary exploitation, where our exploitation takes place not in the factories, but in the process of trying to get a job, where all these intermediary agencies are basically filtering the unemployed population, separating Japanese workers from Korean workers, coding ethnically workers now, surplus populations, precisely in this phase of prolonged economic recession. And it's finally, the last point I'll make is how we can then see what Balibar calls this kind of ascription of verbal and ethnic markers as a modality of this reciprocal union of nationalism and racism. And in the case of Japan during the two wars, in this tense, prolonged, chronic recession, we see Korean workers being not only exploited through semi-feudal, so-called semi-feudal modes of organizing workers, but we start to see a mode of representing Korean workers that directly tries to differentiate them precisely through these verbal markers. And I wanted to mention one time span of a decade in Japan between 1923 and 1933, where we see a development of a kind of racism that seizes upon the language of Korean workers. So in 1923, basically, a couple years after the Korean independence movement in 1919, after Korean anarchism is on the ascendancy in Japan, we see the Japanese police and the army targeting Koreans. And in the wake of this terrible earthquake of 1923, many people know that over 6,000 Korean workers were massacred on the streets of Tokyo and Yokohama. The question that really is frightening is how then did these Koreans, how were they hunted down? They were hunted down police would in the you know after this earthquake, everyone's escaping the city. What the police would do is they would set up little gates and areas, and they would hold up a sign that would have Japanese phonetic script written on it, and it would say they would say "papi pupe po," which is a Japanese phonetic thing and their language, and a Japanese would say "papi pupe po" with a P sound, but a Korean guy, because of their phonetic disposition, they would say "babi bube bo" with more of a B sound, and they would seize upon that phonetic difference, say, "Aha, you're a Korean." They would capture them, tie them up with wires, pour gasoline on them, and set them on fire and put them into the Tokyo River. So this is a horrific, you know, obviously horrific, horrific moment. But then the same grammatical phonetic difference we see appearing 10 years later, after this whole massacre has been repressed systematically by the state, and we see now unemployment agencies in Japan trying to deal with this huge recession with huge unemployment. How do they separate Korean workers from Japanese workers becomes a paramount issue for the state, and they start to issue these handbooks, workbooks for Korean workers only. They called them Chosenjin Senmon Yogoshu, you know, like a book for Korean workers, in which we see it's a completely bizarre text where it teaches Koreans how to speak as workers. They tell them these are the phrases you need to know in Japanese, like "I'm a day worker," "I am no longer a glass factory worker," and they provide a whole vocabulary of what the workers, the Korean workers specifically, is supposed to say, and they make.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.